Hi, my name is Ed Mills and I head up the Employment and Business Immigration team at the law firm Travers Smith.
And I'm Alex Fisher, one of the partners in the team.
And today we're looking at recent cases and developments on employment status. Now, employment status has certainly become something of a hot topic in recent years. You'll have seen reports in the press about workers in the gig economy at the likes of Uber, Deliveroo and Addison Lee claiming employment or worker rights. There was also the high profile case involving Pimlico plumbers and other cases involving TV presenters and sports personalities. So this is an issue which touches on a large number of industries and sectors. And while we're focusing on UK law and developments today, this is certainly not just a UK issue. As you can see on this slide, it's a global issue. There have been issues in the States with whether workers in the gig economy or virtual marketplace companies are employees or self-employed, and whether they benefit from federal and state wage and hours laws. There was also a ruling earlier this year in Australia, which has opened the door for casual workers to receive employment benefits on top of premium pay that they're already receiving. And it's also an issue across Europe, with the EU having adopted a directive on transparent and predictable working conditions last year for those in precarious work. And also in France, there's been a ruling on the employment status of Uber drivers and proposals for reform in this area. So it really is a huge issue globally. And we wanted to take a look today at some of the UK cases and how the law in the UK is adapting to the new ways of working.
That's right. So in terms of what we're planning to cover today, we'll start by looking at employment status. What are the various categories and why does that matter? Then we'll turn to some of the recent cases on employment status that Ed mentioned. And then we'll have a look at the legislative response, so the outcomes of the independent Taylor Review in this area and how these are being implemented through the government's Good Work Plan. And we'll wrap up with a look at the changes to the off-payroll rules coming in next April, which will affect the way organisations engage and tax contractors who provide their services through personal services companies.
Okay, so lots to cover, and kicking off with the categories of employment status. There are currently three different categories for you to think about, three ways in which an individual can provide their services to a business. Obviously, most commonly, you have employees who benefit from the full range of employment rights. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have the self-employed, i.e. people who are effectively operating a business on their own account and who typically provide their services to lots of different clients. And then in the middle, you have this hybrid category of worker, not really self-employed, not quite an employee. And if you were to look at a Venn diagram, it would look a bit like this one we have for you on the slide, because all employees are workers, but not all workers are employees, if that makes sense. So the worker category is a broad category encompassing anyone who's not self-employed. And the big issue in the gig economy is that individuals are typically engaged on a purportedly self-employed basis and treated as self-employed contractors. But the recent string of cases has come from individuals saying that they're not really self-employed, but are workers. And that's because workers have more rights than the self-employed, isn't it, Alex?
Yes. So on the next slide, you can see why employment status matters. As Ed mentioned, only employees benefit from the full range of employment protections, whereas self-employed effectively have none. Workers have some employment protections, but not all. So workers are entitled to national minimum wage, statutory holiday and holiday pay, statutory sick pay protection if they protection if they blow the whistle, and the right to pensions automatic enrolment. But crucially, they don't have unfair dismissal rights, nor are they entitled to notice or notice pay or redundancy pay if their role ceases.
That's right, and it's not always easy to distinguish someone as a worker, is it, Alex? What's the test for worker status?
Yes, it can be difficult to identify who's a worker versus employee or self-employed. A worker is broadly someone who works under a contract of personal service, where the other party to the contract is not a customer or client of theirs. So, breaking that down, there needs to be some sort of contract, and that contract has to be one of personal service, so requiring the individual to do the work themselves. But the third requirement is that the individual is not genuinely self-employed. They're not operating a business or profession on their own account and providing services to clients of that business or profession. And that brings us nicely onto our recent cases. Ed, do you want to kick us off with the Uber decision?
Sure, I will do that. So onto this slide, we have the background there for you. In summary, back in 2016, two Uber drivers brought claims arguing that they were workers and therefore entitled to the national minimum wage and statutory holiday pay. Unsurprisingly, Uber argued that it was simply a technology platform which put self-employed drivers in touch with passengers. But the drivers, again unsurprisingly, said that they were not really self-employed, operating their own businesses, but in reality they were working for Uber. And the tribunal agreed with them. It said the drivers were workers. The tribunal was very critical of the contractual documentation, which went to great lengths to portray the drivers as self-employed. The contract suggested Uber was just an intermediary providing booking and payment services, which connected the drivers with their clients, the passengers. The platform even generated an invoice from the driver to the passenger, but the tribunal said that the contracts and documentation were fictions. They did not reflect the reality of the working relationship. And the reality was that Uber runs a taxi business and the drivers provide their labour as part of that business. And the tribunal also said that Uber exercised a high degree of control over the drivers. Drivers had to follow the route given them by Uber, and they could be removed from the platform if their performance rating was too low or they refused too many bookings once logged in to the app. The tribunal also ruled that drivers were working and therefore entitled to the national minimum wage when they had the app turned on and were ready and willing to accept fares. So Uber appealed this a couple of times, first to the Employment Appeal Tribunal and then on to the Court of Appeal. But each time the courts have upheld the tribunal's ruling that the drivers are workers. And Uber has now appealed to the Supreme Court, and the case was heard a few weeks ago on the 21st and 22nd of July, and we're now awaiting a judgment. So that is definitely one to look out for in the next few months.
Yeah, absolutely. And this idea that the drivers were working when they were logged onto the app, that's problematic, isn't it? It's clear that someone is working once they've accepted a trip, but when someone is logged onto the app, they're effectively on standby. So they might not actually be working. And in reality, lots of couriers and drivers are logged on to multiple apps at any one time. So they could be entitled to the national minimum wage from various different companies for that same period of time. But this also came up in the next case, which involved Addison Lee. The facts are very similar to Uber. So three drivers for Addison Lee claimed that they were workers and entitled to the national minimum wage and to holiday pay. And the tribunal also ruled that they were workers. Again, the tribunal said that the drivers were workers. Now, they also had contracts which described them as independent contractors and as subcontractors of Addison Lee, and in some cases referred to Addison Lee as their agent. And again, the tribunal said that these contracts didn't really reflect reality. Also, again similar to Uber, Addison Lee exercised a high degree of control over the drivers. The drivers had to hire vehicles from Addison Lee with the company logo on them, and also in practice had to work a certain number of hours to recover those hire costs. When a driver was logged onto the company system, they had to accept jobs notified by the system promptly. If they failed to do so, they would have to give an acceptable reason, otherwise they could be subject to sanctions. So the drivers were in reality workers and entitled to national minimum wage and holiday pay. In terms of working time, the tribunal said that the drivers were working when they were logged on to Addison Lee's computerized systems. Even though they might not actually be carrying passengers, they were at that time at the company's disposal. The Employment Appeals Tribunal has upheld this ruling, and there's been a further appeal to the Court of Appeal, but that hearing has been stayed pending the outcome of the Supreme Court ruling in Uber, given that the two cases are so similar.
Indeed, that's right. So a couple of points I think to take away from all of this, Alex, from these first two cases. The first is that the written contract and other documentation, it's not determinative. So in both Uber and Addison Lee, the tribunals effectively ignored the written documents as they didn't reflect the reality of the situation. In fact, the written documents can be actively unhelpful if they are really artificial and go to great lengths to suggest people are not workers or employees, as tribunals will think there is something to hide. Second key point is around control, and this is a pervasive theme of today's session. Control will be a big factor in determining whether someone is an employee or worker or not. And the more control the company has over things like how and when and where the work is done, the more likely someone is an employee or worker. You would expect someone who is self-employed in the gig economy to be able to choose how much or how little they work, but in both these cases, drivers were penalised for refusing bookings.
Absolutely. And the other big factor here is substitution, which comes up in the next two cases. So first up is Pimlico Plumbers. Here you had a plumber, Mr. Smith, who worked for Pimlico for 5.5 years. Pimlico terminated his engagement a few months after he'd suffered a heart attack, and he brought claims for unfair dismissal, holiday pay, national minimum wage, and also disability discrimination. Now, the unfair dismissal claim failed because he would have had to have been an employee, and the tribunal said he was not an employee. But he was a worker, so he was entitled to holiday pay and the national minimum wage. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and at each stage the worker ruling was upheld. Again, this came down to control. So Mr. Smith, under his contract, had to be available for at least 40 hours a week. He wasn't allowed to work for a competitor, and there was even a non-compete saying he couldn't work for a competitor for 3 months following termination. He also had to wear a uniform and carry an ID card, both with the company logo. He also had a company branded van and a phone which he had to hire from the company and pay for himself. This level of control meant he was not self-employed. Pimlico Plumbers was not a client of Mr. Smith's business, rather he was working for them. The other factor which was relevant was substitution. Now, I said earlier that the test for a worker is someone who is under a contractual obligation to provide their services personally, where the other party to the contract is not a client or a customer of theirs. Now, the personal service element means that in some cases, tribunals have held that where the individual can send a substitute to perform the work, the element of personal service is missing. In this case, Mr. Smith did have a right to send a substitute, but it was a very limited right. He could swap jobs with another Pimlico plumber, but he couldn't send an external third party to do the job. So Mr. Smith was still under an obligation to perform the services personally, which meant he satisfied the worker definition. The personal services requirement is only missing where there is an unfettered right to substitution, which I think came up in your next case, Ed.
Indeed it did, that's right. So turning to the Deliveroo case then on this next slide. Now this case is particularly interesting as it's the only gig economy case which has decided that the individuals are genuinely self-employed rather than workers. So in this case, the Independent Workers Union of Great Britain, bit of a mouthful, applied for trade union recognition on behalf of Deliveroo riders. Trade union recognition for collective bargaining purposes is only available for workers, not self-employed people. So a fundamental preliminary point was whether the riders were workers. And the Central Arbitration Committee ruled that the riders were genuinely self-employed. And one of the keys to the decision was that the riders were free to subcontract deliveries or appoint a substitute in their place. And unlike the last case, it was a broad right. They could send anyone they liked and they remained responsible for paying the substitute. The CAC said that because of the unfettered right of substitution, there was no obligation on the riders to perform services personally, so the key element of personal service was missing and the riders could not be workers. Now, the union launched a judicial review of the decision, which was dismissed by the High Court in December 2018. The case has been appealed to the Court of Appeal and is due to be heard later this year, but the appeal is all to do whether self-employed contractors should have the right to collective bargaining, not about whether the riders are or were workers. The case, as I mentioned, was a decision of the Central Arbitration Committee rather than an employment tribunal, but it does, I think, highlight the significance of substitution in the test for worker status.
Okay, moving on now from the case law onto legislative developments. So how has the law in the UK adapted to all this uncertainty around employment status and changes in the way people work, in particular in the gig economy? Well, the key legislative development is the government's Good Work Plan. The Good Work Plan sets out a range of reforms to employment law designed to provide clarity and enhance protection for workers. And this all began with the Taylor Review. And you have a timeline there on the slide. So in 2016, the government commissioned Matthew Taylor to undertake an independent review of modern working practices. This was partly a response to the gig economy and cases such as Uber, where workers in the gig economy were seeking to reclassify themselves and assert worker rights. The purpose of the review was to consider what, if any, changes should be made to UK employment law to adapt to new models of working, in particular to the gig economy. So the Taylor Review was a review of employment law in light of modern working practices. Matthew Taylor published his report in 2017, and it made 53 recommendations for reform of employment law. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go through all 53 recommendations, but the government has said it is going to take forward the vast majority of those. So in 2018, the government published 4 consultations, picking up the key recommendations from the Taylor Review. And they covered employment status and various definitions of the 3 different categories of employment status. There was also a consultation about agency workers and 2 further consultations about transparency and enforcement of employment rights. Later that year, the government also published the Good Work Plan, which sets out the government strategy for a package of reforms which take into account the Taylor Review and the consultation process and those responses. The government's strategy has set out in 3 main themes, so fair and decent work, clarity for employers and workers, and fairer enforcement. You see, the main concerns of the Taylor Review were essentially that both workers and employers lack clarity around the status of different types of workers and what rights they have. There are lots of people on casual and 0 hours contracts in precarious work with one-sided flexibility who are expected to be available on demand but have no certainty on when they will be called on or how much work they will receive. And there needs to be better enforcement of employment rights. Now, some of the changes under the Good Work Plan have been implemented, while others are still pending. And we're going to take you through the key ones now.
Thanks for that, Alex. So the key proposal, particularly given today's discussion, is around employment status and the definition of employment status. So the Taylor Review proposed that the definition of a worker needed to be clearer, and it actually proposed renaming the worker category as dependent contractor to reflect the fact that a worker is really a contractor who is largely dependent on one employer client for the majority of their work. The Taylor Review also said there should be less focus on personal service and the right of substitution, and more emphasis on control in the relationship between an employer and a dependent contractor. Under the Good Work Plan, the government has said it will legislate to improve clarity of the employment status test, reflecting the reality of modern working practices. However, there is currently no timescale for this, and it appears that there has been little movement on this since the Good Work Plan was published back in 2018. Now, clearly, Brexit and the COVID situation have had a role to play in that, but it's a huge task actually to try to redefine the test for employee, worker, and the self-employed. But it is something that the government has committed to do, so we may see more on that in the future. We certainly hope so. Now, the second proposal to address the point Alex mentioned earlier about one-sided flexibility. The government has said it's going to give all workers the right to request, so the right to request a more stable contract. So how this would work is if you're on a 0 hours contract but you regularly work over 20 hours a week, you could submit a request to your employer for a contract that guarantees you 20 hours. Now, the right would only apply to workers with at least 26 weeks service, and the right would be, as I said, a right to request. The employer would not have to agree to it, but the employer would have to consider it seriously and respond within 3 months with good business reasons as to why it can't offer the guaranteed contract. So it would be quite similar, in fact, to the process for a flexible working request. At least that was the proposal under the Good Work Plan. In 2019, so a year or so later, the Low Pay Commission suggested that workers should have a direct right to switch to a contract that reflected their normal hours rather than merely a right to request, i.e. the employer couldn't say no. And Bees stated in response that it would take forward the recommendation, which seems to go further than its commitment under the Good Work Plan. But again, there's no timescale on this, and nothing has happened since Bees made that statement in July 2019, over a year ago. So again, watch this space. And then finally, on this slide, the government has said that it would increase the gap required to break continuity of service. So, as many of you will know, at the moment, a gap of 1 week breaks continuity, which means if, as a casual worker, your engagement comes to an end and there is more than a 1 week gap before you're rehired, then the clock will start ticking again on rights which require a certain amount of service, like unfair dismissal or statutory redundancy pay, which both require 2 years' service. The government is going to increase the gap required to break continuity from 1 week to 4 weeks, which means that it will be easier for casuals to accrue employment rights. Again, there's been no time frame put on this as yet, so we will have to wait and see again.
Okay, so turning to the next slide with a couple of changes where there is a time frame. In fact, a couple of changes which have been implemented already. So first up, earlier this year, changes were made to the requirements on employers to provide written statements of particulars or employment terms. Now, previously, these had been provided to employees only and provided within 4 weeks of an employee starting work. As of the 6th of April this year, employers must now provide a written statement of particulars for all workers, so not just employees. And this statement has to be provided by the first day of work. So it is now a day one right. And this is really to address the point that lots of workers are not aware of their rights and their benefits. And the written statement now also needs to contain some additional information. So on top of things like salary, hours, pension entitlement, the statement also needs to include details of other benefits provided by the employer. The statement also needs to contain details of any paid leave other than holiday or sick pay. So that would include family-friendly leave, but it is fine to refer to a separate policy rather than have that in the document. And the statement also needs to set out any training the worker is required to undergo, and also whether or not the worker's hours will vary, and if so, how that variation is determined. A similar change was made to payslips last April. So as of 6th of April 2019, payslips now need to be provided to all workers, not just to employees. And where workers are paid an hourly rate, the payslip needs to specify the rate and the number of hours worked. This is particularly important for those paid overtime or other variable rates. This is all about transparency, ensuring that workers know what their entitlements are. Now, lots of employers updated their standard employment contracts to take account of these changes, but with COVID, many also didn't get around to it. But employers should generally update their contracts to reflect the changes so they are in place for any new hires that they take on.
That's right, and I think we tend to find it's a relatively straightforward job for most of our employer clients to do that, but certainly worth doing it when the dust settles on COVID, if not before. So Moving on to a couple of other changes on the next slide then. So first up is holiday pay. And the reference period for calculating holiday pay was amended on the 6th of April this year. So for workers with variable hours or whose pay varies, the way that you calculate holiday pay is to take an average of pay over a reference period. And previously this was a 12-week look-back period, but on the 6th of April this year, the reference period increased to 52 weeks. The idea is that a year gives you a more representative indication of someone's average pay, and it evens out any peaks and troughs, so workers are not disadvantaged if they take holiday at a quiet time of the year when their weekly pay may be lower. Second is on works councils, and the threshold for setting up a works council has been lowered. So previously, an employer had to set up a works council if it had a valid request from 10% of the workforce. As of the 6th of April this year, the threshold has been lowered significantly to just 2% of the workforce, subject though always to needing a minimum of 15 employees. The government believes that high levels of employee engagement lead to more fulfilling work, so wants to encourage more consultation with workers. I think it's fair to say we haven't yet seen a flood of new works councils, but you never know if that's coming down the pipe. On the flip side to that change, the cost of breaching employment law for employers has become more expensive. So where there is an aggravated breach of employment law, the maximum penalty has gone up from £5,000 to £20,000. This is on top of any compensation awarded to the individual. And in terms of what constitutes aggravating behaviour, there'd have to be some sort of deliberate or malicious breach generally, or perhaps even a repeated breach of the same employment rights. So these are rarely awarded, but they're intended to disincentivize rogue employers who disregard employment rights altogether. I'm sure that doesn't count any of you in their number. Alex.
Okay, so Ed mentioned earlier that employment status is a hot topic globally. And one of the reasons for that is that employment status determines the way that somebody is taxed. And tax authorities in many countries are looking to increase their tax revenue. And one good example of that in the UK is our next topic, so the off-payroll worker rules. These are new rules about how organisations tax contractors who supply their services through a limited company or a personal services company. They already apply in the public sector. They've been in the public sector since 2017. And they're going to apply to all large and medium-sized businesses in the private sector from April next year. They essentially revise the IR35 position. So IR35 is a piece of tax legislation which says that whenever you engage someone who provides their services to you through a limited company, you have to decide whether, if you took away the personal services company, that individual would be an employee for tax purposes. If the answer to that question is yes, then the contractor needs to be taxed as though they are an employee. At the moment in the private sector, the responsibility for applying IR35 rests with the contractor and their personal services company. So it's up to the personal services company to decide if IR35 applies, and if so, to account for the right tax and national insurance. But what is changing from April 2021 is that it will be the end client or the engager that needs to make the determination under IR35. And if IR35 applies, it will be the fee payer who has to account for tax and national insurance. So in a straightforward relationship where the client engages the personal services company directly, it's the client who must deduct the tax and the national insurance. where the contractor is engaged through an agency, it will be the agency who pays the personal services company who needs to deduct the tax and the national insurance. But the determination on whether IR35 applies always needs to be made by the client. So the client has to produce what's called a status determination statement and issue this to the contractor and the agency if there is one. The statement must say whether the client believes IR35 applies and provide reasons. The contractor or the agency then has the right to challenge that, and if a challenge is made, the client must consider that and respond in writing within 45 days, either upholding the original determination or issuing a fresh one. Now, as I said, these rules were introduced in the public sector in 2017, and the government believes they are working well there, so is very keen to introduce them into the private sector. The changes were actually due to come into play in the private sector in April this year, but they were delayed until next year because of the pandemic. So employers have been given an extra 12 months to prepare.
That's right, and there's been some speculation, I think, Alex, that this may not happen next April. What do you think about that? Is there any sense that this could be kicked further down the road or maybe even scrapped altogether?
So it's a good question, Ed, and the off-payroll rules have come under a lot of criticism, particularly from the House of Lords, who've said that they should be scrapped or at the very least delayed further, because businesses will still be recovering from the pandemic in April next year. But at this stage at least, the government seems adamant to introduce the rules in April 2021. In fact, the legislation introducing the off-payroll rules, so the finance bill, has now been made. So the government is certainly behaving as if the changes will come into effect in April next year. And also, when the Chancellor announced support for self-employed people, he flagged that it will be harder to justify differences in contributions between the employed and self-employed in future, suggesting the intention to press ahead with these changes. Of course, the government is going to have a huge debt to recover, and the off-payroll rules were always going to be a big source of revenue for the government. So only time will tell, but for now, we have to assume that they are coming into force in April next year.
That makes sense to me. So Alex, what should our clients and other businesses be doing now to prepare for those new rules?
That's a great question. Well, in the latter part of this year or very early next year, clients are going to need to get to grips again with their contractor populations. Many organisations conducted audits earlier this year, but are going to have to re-audit their workforce to see how many contractors they have and how long engagements will run for. Secondly, clients will need to consider on what basis they're going to engage the contractor going forwards. If it's determined that IR35 applies, does it make more sense to engage the contractor as an employee, for example? Clients may also want to amend the wording in their consultancy agreements to reflect the deductions for tax and national insurance. And finally, clients are going to have to prepare a fresh status determination statement for each of their contractors sometime before April next year. And that's the case even if they have already done a status determination statement. This will need to be reviewed and updated, as it is possible that things may have changed. And clients will also need to have in place an appeals process to deal with any challenges by either the contractors or agencies.
Thank you, Alex. Quite a lot to think about there then. So indeed, that almost finishes up our session. Certainly been a lot of developments on employment status recently, which I guess is why this is and remains such a hot topic. Plenty more developments to come. It's going to be an area of some interest for quite some time, we think. So that concludes all we were planning to say on the topic. If you have any queries or feedback on the webinar or the associated issues, or indeed any employment law or business immigration issues, our contact details are there on this final slide. Please don't hesitate to get in touch. And that just leaves me to say thank you very much for joining us today, and good afternoon.